Hello, and welcome to On Science, the weekly podcast from the Science Desk at National Public Radio. I'm Chris Joyce.
I am here today to lend my support to what I believe to be one of the most important pieces of legislation ever introduced in the Congress.
That is, not Chris Joyce, that is Al Gore, of course, the former vice president and one of the leading voices on the subject of climate change. He's talking on Capitol Hill there before the Energy and Commerce Subcommittee. Congress is considering a new bill to curb climate change, and Al Gore is very happy about it.
I believe this legislation has the moral significance equivalent to that of the civil rights legislation of the 1960s and the Marshall Plan of the late 1940s. By repowering America with a transition to a clean energy economy and ending our dangerous over-reliance on carbon-based fuels, this bill will simultaneously address the climate crisis, the economic crisis, and the national security threats that stem from our dependence on foreign oil.
The bill that Al Gore is talking about was introduced by Senator Henry Waxman from California. It's in hearings right now. There are other bills that are in the process of being written. Bits and pieces from each of them are likely to become finally an energy and climate bill that will be debated, well, nobody knows for how long. The White House has been fairly quiet on it so far, but it's going to take some arm twisting and a lot of heavy lifting to get this bill through Congress this year, if at all this year. We'll be following it all along. And later in the program, we're going to be talking to someone who's been watching this process very closely, spending a lot of time on Capitol Hill figuring out who's going to vote for and against the climate legislation. But first, in the meantime, we're going to take a look at what it means to be a cow, to the essence of bovinity. And for that, we've called in John Hamilton. John, welcome.
Glad to be here.
So there is astonishing, utterly astonishing news, sorry about that, coming out of Science Magazine this week. It has to do with the genome of the cow. Tell us what they've found.
Yes, they have completed the first full sequence of the bovine genome.
Is that a big deal?
Well, it's a big deal if you're in the dairy or the beef industry, because after all, you're in the business of trying to make better and better cows.
And can you make a better cow at this point, knowing that what the genes are, all the genes in the genome?
Well, the people who did the genome think that, yes, you can. I mean, if you look at the bovine genome, if you look at what makes cattle cattle, you see that they have some what they call genetic hotspots at exactly the places you would expect. For instance, milk production and the ability, the amazing digestive ability to turn grasses, cellulose in essence, into fuel.
Mm-hmm. I suppose there are people out there, I know several of them, in fact, who would be quite happy if they could now engineer a cow with milk that didn't have lactose. I suppose, is that a possibility?
I'm not sure that, and nobody I talked to raised that possibility. They did talk about how it's relatively easy to look at genetic patterns and change things like, for instance, the fat content of milk, and for that matter, the fat content of beef. And that's the kind of thing that you're probably going to see more of in the future.
You know, in the past, there have been genomes. We know the genome of the mouse. We know the genome of lots of other organisms. I mean, in fact, I think cows have been cloned. Are there any objections that have arisen about, you know, should we be doing this? Is this going to lead down the garden path to cows that, you know, with wings or cows with things that they shouldn't have?
I think any time you get into genetic manipulation of an animal that's in the food chain, in our food chain, you have a lot of people worried about the Frankenfood, you know, the specter of this. But, you know, the fact is that we have manipulated cattle already so much through selective breeding that it shouldn't come as a surprise to us if we see, you know, more changes that are just done through a sort of shortcut.
You know, there's more to the cow than the cow, because that did come out in your story, which is that a cow has this fabulous ability to digest stuff, that cellulose that other animals can't, or most other animals can't digest, because of the bacteria that are in their gut or their rumen. I wonder whether this is going to give people any guidance in how to manipulate the bacteria that are in there.
Well, some of the scientists that I spoke with think it will, because a part of what the cow does, what part of what cattle do in, as you say, the rumen is essentially this fermentation vat, and it does a lot of what we are trying to do to make fuel out of cellulose. It takes grassy cellulose type plants and it turns them into fuel. Now, it doesn't turn them into, say, ethanol, which is what we'd like to do. But there's the thinking is that the bacteria that accomplish this inside a cow may be useful for doing this in a laboratory somewhere.
Those bacteria do something else. I ran into this in New Zealand, actually, where people are trying to limit the amount of methane, which is a greenhouse gas that causes global warming, out of the front end, the back of cows. Methane is actually produced not by the cow, really, but produced by bacteria. And in fact, they're trying to manipulate those bacteria to get the cow to stop making so much methane. I mean, not that we should blame cows for global warming, but
There's talk about that as well. And in fact, you might want to do two things. If it comes to global warming, you might want to decrease the amount of methane that's produced in the rumen of cattle, because that gets belched out for the most part and is not good in the atmosphere. On the other hand, if you had a bunch of these bacteria working on plant matter somewhere else, you might want them to make as much methane as possible, because methane is a fuel that we can burn and generate power from.
Mm-hmm. Well, is this your last bovine story for the year, or can we expect some more?
Well, you never know. I mean, the bovine genome is endlessly fascinating, and I'm sure that there will be more studies. Actually, the thing that's likely to happen from this is that in the coming months, maybe years, I think there is going to be word from the people who are cattle breeders and the people who are breeders of dairy cattle on precisely how they're going to use this information to try to make better cows.
Better in the sense of happier or more milk?
Well, I don't know if they're going to be happier or not, but they'll probably produce more milk and more beef and perhaps varieties of milk or beef, as in low-fat, high-fat, that will be highly marketable.
Okay. Appreciate it.
Good to be here.
See you later.
Bye-bye.
Moo. And it's not such a great leap from methane coming from cows back to Capitol Hill. There is a lot of hot air on Capitol Hill, but one of the things that we want to find out is what's going on with that climate legislation that will hopefully put a curb on some of that methane. One thing that we're doing in our weekly science podcast is getting out of the building, not often enough, but we try now and then, to talk to people in Washington about what's going on in science and politics. And we've decided to come over to our favorite hangout, Busboys and Poets, to talk to somebody who's an expert in climate change and what's going on Capitol Hill and climate change. And we're here with Kara Saul Rinaldi. Hi, Kara.
Hi, Chris. I'm very happy to be here.
So, Kara, tell me about the place that you work and what you do there first so that we can legitimize your opinion.
I am a policy specialist at the Environmental Resources Management. It's a international consulting firm that works with companies and nonprofits and others to try and help them understand their environmental issues and their environmental problems.
Including climate change.
Including climate change.
So you've spent a couple of days now on Capitol Hill, I guess, listening, talking, gathering information about this cap-and-trade bill. Tell us, well, first of all, tell us a little bit about what the bill is supposed to do and why it's important.
Well, it's a large bill and many hundreds of pages of legislation that covers everything from energy and energy efficiency and advancing renewable energy to providing for the development of a cap-and-trade system. So that would reduce carbon dioxide emissions by as much as 83% to 85% by 2050.
Tell us about cap and trade. I've heard that phrase a lot. I think I know what it means, but I'm not sure everybody does. What's the cap and what's the trade all about? And I assume that this is a big part of what the bill is all about.
Yes. Well, the cap and trade portion is a large portion of this legislation, but there's also some very important energy provisions that are also in the bill. But to look at the cap and trade, what a cap and trade does essentially is it caps the emissions in the United States and then ratchets them down so that industry who emit carbon dioxide or carbon dioxide equivalent, meaning they're having high global warming potential gases, must reduce those gases from their processes. Now, the majority of greenhouse gases come from power plant emissions and from vehicles. Mm-hmm. So that's where the majority of the of the emissions come from. But there are certainly some industries that are will be affected by it: the cement, glass, steel, industries that rely heavily on power to and fuel for feedstock.
So my understanding is that if this bill becomes a law, what will happen is that there'll be a limit on how much of these carbon dioxide equivalents can be emitted. So if I'm a cement company or if I'm a utility that's making electric power, I get a certain number of permits or allocations, and I'm not allowed to go beyond that, right?
Yes, but the allocation aspects are left in the bill up to debate. That's actually one very specific point that this bill isn't addressing, is where the allocations go. So, I mean, there's allocations per year, but not per industry.
It just seems odd that the whole business of how much you're allowed to emit is left out of a bill that's supposed to limit your emissions of carbon dioxide. I mean, what good is the bill if it doesn't say how much you're allowed to emit?
Oh, well, it does. It says how much in total is allowed to be emitted, but it doesn't say
who gets what.
It doesn't give those specific allocations. And the bill's a draft bill. This bill does not have a bill number. Yeah, so it's not final yet. It's very far along, but I think this was an opportunity to get significant input from the key members on the Energy and Commerce Committee, to get input from industry, to get input from all of the stakeholders that matter, the environmental community, and find out, you know, and really have an opportunity to tackle these issues kind of more of in a public forum.
There have been other, you know, climate change bills that have been introduced in Congress before, and they didn't pass. What's going to make this one more likely, if it is, to pass? Is it going to go through, or is it going to be just another example of debate that doesn't go anywhere?
I think that today we are in a different political world when it comes to climate change than we were even last year. But there has been a rising sense of consciousness in the United States about climate change and concerns about climate change. There's been a rising consensus around the world. There have been more scientific documentation about climate change impacts. But I think most importantly, whether you believe climate change is happening or not, whether you think it's something that we should address or not, the political and consciousness raising and social thought on this matter has gotten to the point where we're going to see legislation. The issue is no longer if we're going to have legislation, but when we're going to have legislation. And no longer do we have a White House which was certain to veto a bill. So it's not... Now we have a White House which has said time and again that they believe climate change is a concern and there needs to be a program to address it.
Traditionally, you know, industry has been really reluctant when it came to limiting things like sulfur dioxide or other pollutants. You know, it was kicking, dragging, and screaming. Is that the situation now? I mean, if they don't accept a cap and trade, what would they face otherwise?
There is going to be limits on carbon emissions for a number of recent and somewhat recent findings. The Supreme Court the Supreme Court in 2007 said that the Environmental Protection Agency doesn't only have the authority to regulate carbon dioxide under the Clean Air Act, but that, in fact, they must do it if they find that it's an endangerment to human health. The endangerment finding has just come out, and in fact, we've found that in the Obama administration, the new Obama administration's EPA has determined that carbon dioxide is an endangerment to human health. And that means that kind of sets the stage for regulating under the Clean Air Act. What that's going to mean is that if Congress does not act to regulate carbon dioxide, the administration, it will have to.
I mean, one thing that seems to be difficult to swallow on Capitol Hill is the idea that this is going to cost people money. It's going to cost industry money, and they'll pass the costs on. Our electricity costs will be higher. And, you know, I hear statements from members of Congress who say, oh, I'm all for this so long as it doesn't cost the taxpayer any more money, so long as it doesn't slow down the economy, so long as it doesn't raise electricity rates. Is that realistic?
There are so many different ways that you could cut this legislation, and there will be a cost to carbon. So as a result, somebody's going to have to pay for something, because those who emit carbon today are going to need to emit carbon tomorrow, and therefore
when it costs them.
Even when it costs them, right? Whereas right now they can do it for free, and tomorrow they might not be able to do it for free, and that's the trade-off. So will those costs be passed on to consumers? Well, it'll depend on exactly how they're done. And in some ways, where does that cost go? We also have to think about that. When someone pays, let's say, $15 for a carbon emission to emit a ton of carbon, that $15 goes into a pot of money. Where's that money going to go? Is that money going to go back to energy efficiency programs and renewable energy and other things which will then lower the cost to consumers? It really depends on a lot of factors. And I think one of that is how those monies are used.
So what it sounds to me like is that this isn't simply a bill that's going to say, okay, here's a limit on carbon emissions for the country. We're going to figure out who gets what permission or what allocation. Cement gets so much, utilities get so much, but this is much more complex. It's really changing the way we use energy with sort of climate reduction or reducing global warming as a subtext for lots of different ways that really will revamp the entire energy economy.
In a sense, it's changing the way we see energy. It's not just the way we use it, but the way we see it, the way we understand it. That our energy use is, I think many people understand how that their that when they drive their car and they drive behind a bus and they can feel the particulate matter. They know that there's energy use. They know that there's an impact on the environment, but they don't always know that when they turn on a light switch or they plug something in, that they're also impacting the environment. And it's going to change the way not only how we see energy, but also the way in which we see carbon. As I said, carbon dioxide right now doesn't cost anything. It's going to cost something. So, and we all emit it. So there's going to be a real change in the way we see energy, the way we use energy, the way we think about our energy use.
A lot of your clients are in business, although I think some of them are also environmental groups. I mean, it runs a gamut, but let's just talk about the business folks for a minute. When you're sort of this person in Washington who hangs out in Capitol Hill, hangs out in the Senate, talks to people who are on the staff of Senate committees and House committees, and you come back, and what do they ask you? You know, they're out in Pennsylvania or Utah or Washington State, and they don't know exactly what's going on. That's your job. What do they ask you about cap and trade, about what's going on with climate legislation? Are we going to get hurt? Is there a way to make money? I mean, what do they come to you with?
Well, that's pretty much what they come to me with. I think industry around the country, again, wants certainty, and they want to know what their risk is, and they want to know what they can plan for. Nobody likes to budget not knowing what next year is going to bring. And I mean, without having a cap and trade program, knowing that we are going to cap carbon, that countries around the world are addressing their carbon emissions, that we are going to address our carbon emissions, that the president has said we have to address our carbon emissions, that the Supreme Court said that EPA needs to address this, that states around this country have already capped carbon emissions in states, that...
I think you're telling me the writing is on the wall.
Yes. The writing's on the wall, but it's not decipherable yet. And they need to know what it is that they can plan for. They need to know how much emissions they can have. They need to know what their production's going to look like. They need to know if it's going to be cost-effective to invest in advanced technologies to reduce carbon emissions. Once you add a price to carbon, you change the whole structure of what's cost-effective to invest in.
I think that about does it. Thanks, Kara, for coming and talking to us.
Thanks so much for having me.
We'll do it again.
Anytime.
That's Carousel Rinaldi from Environmental Resources Management. I think I got that name right.
Thank you.
And that's it for this edition of On Science. We love hearing from you, so please write to us at nprscience@npr.org. And after you've done that, come back again next week, download our podcast, and have a listen. We'll have more information on science. I'm Christopher Joyce.